The next case we have, the second of four oral arguments that we have today, A230368, Anthony Inc. is appellant versus Richard L. Morris et al., the respondents. As you, I think you were both in here previously, I heard we asked that you do identify yourself for the record when you bring in your statements. There's a button you maybe noticed also in front of the podium, so you can go up or down as necessary. Do keep your eye on the time clock as best you can as well. And we are recording these proceedings, so the recording will be available within 24 hours. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may approach, identify yourself, and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name's Keith Johnson, and I'm representing the appellants in this matter. Anthony Inc., the personal representatives of the estate of Stephen Meyer, his wife, Kathleen Bloomer Meyer, and his daughter, Melanie Meyer, and also the three members of the Steve Meyer family, the mother, the daughter I just mentioned, and their son, Maxwell Meyer. What I would like to address with the court today is what we are asserting was an error by the district court in dismissing this case, which asserted conversion and a treble damage claim against attorney Robert Morris. Now, I've been practicing over 40 years, and this is the first time I encountered a judgment on the pleadings. Looking at this, the standard of review is important. It's de novo review. Every fact set forth in the complaint is to be considered as true. All inferences are to be drawn in favor of the appellants in this case. And every benefit of the doubt right now is to be given to the appellants in this case. Now, in this case, Your Honor, this case...
Can I ask one clarifying question?
Yes.
It appears from your brief that you're not arguing the district court incorrectly dismissed your civil theft claim. Is that correct, that you've dropped your civil theft
claim? I have.
Okay.
We are limiting
your negligence claim?
Yes. We are limiting the claim to conversion, and we are asserting a claim for treble damages based on the act of conversion.
Mr. Johnson, as you begin that discussion, I'm going to pose a question. Would you agree that the issue of whether you've properly pled purposes of the Rule 12 conversion, if we agreed with the district court, then pretty much all of the other issues, whether derivative or direct, et cetera, kind of naturally go away?
If you're asking me that there is no way that the complaint properly alleged conversion, I would agree with you. If that was a question, Your Honor, if I understood your question.
Well, my question really goes more to your stated issues. You start out with the issue of whether you could pursue treble damages as part of the conversion under the attorney statute, the malpractice statute 481.07 and 071. And then you reference issue two, whether appellant's claim for conversion was direct versus derivative, and then finally, of course, the issue of amending the complaint. I guess my question is, separate from whether the claim should have been, was a derivative claim versus direct, if you don't properly allege conversion, that other issue doesn't matter, it just goes away, correct?
If you're saying, if I don't properly allege conversion, it doesn't matter if this is a direct
correct.
Or derivative claim?
Yes.
I'm not sure that's true, Your Honor.
Well,
can I address the direct derivative claim?
Let me ask this. No, I want to talk about conversion because the first element of conversion is that the plaintiff was to have possession of the money that was converted.
Correct.
And as the court noted and the record seems to support, the entity 415 had the right to any property, if there was a right to any property to have, not your client. So how can you successfully claim conversion if your client did not have a right to the property?
Your Honor, the client did have a right to the property, so we can allege conversion. It's that simple. The district court was incorrect and made error in indicating that this was a derivative claim for the benefit of 415 LLC. Well, it was a direct claim.
And I'm separating that issue because I wanted to get to conversion, and although it's embedded perhaps in the discussion, but the court separately had a separate section. The point being is that conversion wasn't there. There's no claim of conversion here because there's not a proper allegation that your client, being Anthony, as opposed to 415, had a right to the money that was in that trust account.
Your Honor, this matter was a corporate LLC dissolution.
Correct. And this, it was 415, not Anthony. 415 was going through dissolution.
Correct.
And it was 415 that money was held in the trust account for.
I disagree with that, Your Honor.
How so, and where in the record?
There is the dissolution statute, 322C.0707, discusses the situation of winding up of an LLC. And what it basically says is that when an LLC is winding up, number one, the expenses of the LLC get paid in full. All the expenses. Get them done, pay them out. After that, the remaining surplus of the LLC assets are to be paid to the members. That's exactly the situation we're in here, Your Honor. In the complaint,
the funds were in the IOTA account. They were funds of 415 LLC, of the 415 LLC, correct?
I won't agree with that, Your Honor. They're not 415 LLC. The property's being wound down. The LLC is being wound down.
But where in the record does it show that the property is in the name of Anthony Inc.?
Your Honor, that's what I wanted to get to.
Not in the record. Where in the complaint do you allege that the funds from the sale belong to, or that Anthony Inc. has a property interest in those funds? Because in your brief, you cite not Minnesota law, but Florida law, which I was a little confused by. But Minnesota law is clear that the elements of common law conversion are, one, the plaintiff holds a property interest, and two, the defendant deprives plaintiff of that interest. So I think the question before us is, does the complaint allege that Anthony Inc. had a property interest in those funds? And I think what the complaint alleges is that the net proceeds be held in the IOTA account on behalf of 415. I don't see, maybe I'm missing it and you can point me to it, but I don't see an allegation that Anthony Inc. holds a property interest in those funds.
Your Honor, in the complaint at paragraph 8.
Paragraph 8, okay.
The parties entered a stipulated order directing the sale of the building with the sale proceeds held in the IOTA account on behalf of 415. Now, the stipulated order, Your Honor, required the payment of all expenses, including the two mortgages on the property. So the parties were ordered pay all expenses. Based on the standard in a judgment on the pleadings, those expenses were paid. That's the truth. That's the fact. It's in the complaint.
So, but what you've alleged in your complaint here is consistent with what I was saying, that they were held on behalf of 415. I don't see an allegation that your client, Anthony Inc., had a property interest in those funds.
As soon as the expenses were paid.
Point me to the language in the complaint. That's what I'm asking.
I guess the stipulated order required that the expenses be paid, Your Honor. The stipulated order is attached to the complaint. The order says pay the expenses, so the...
How does that tie in? I didn't understand whether expenses are paid is the basis of your lawsuit. It's conversion, And so that would seem to be many steps later that if expenses are paid and there's money and then the money wasn't split equally between the shareholders or the members of the LLC, then you might somewhere start get down to a conversion. But what's the relationship of expenses being paid and conversion?
If you look at the statute 322C.0707, it says that after the expenses are paid, the remaining surplus of the LLC assets are to be distributed directly to the members. And that's where the members in this case developed their expectancy interest in this money. The money was in the IOLTA account. It was after the expenses have been paid, and it basically should be proven for purposes of this motion those expenses were paid. The only issue was distribution of the surplus to the two members of 415 LLC. So that's where there was an expectancy interest of my clients, and that's where Mr. Morris had an obligation to recognize that expectancy interest.
Can you point to the paragraphs in your complaint that you make that allegation?
I guess I'm just going to rely on paragraphs 8 through 12, Your Honor, and I guess I'll have to read through it if you want me to do that. I don't have a lot of time left, but I think it's just important to recognize that we are basically saying that this was a LLC distribution, it was winding up, the expenses had been paid, and the issue was here was all about making the appropriate payments to the two members of 415 LLC. We feel that we properly set forth a claim of conversion. We're saying that Mr. Morris willfully interfered with my client's personal property.
Let me ask the follow-up question then on the second element of conversion. Where in the complaint do you allege that Mr. Morris in particular deprived your client of money that was held in this IOLTA account?
In the conversion claim, Your Honor.
Well, it's a bit of a circular answer. I get where in the complaint, though. In other words, I understand the allegation, what's stated in there, and it seems to be supported by the record, but it's in the complaint and not disputed, that Mr. Morris signed on behalf of Anthony the stipulation and an order that led to the single governor being able to make decisions as part of the wind down. But what I'm asking about is where in the complaint do you allege that Mr. Morris deprived your client of any money it was owed?
Paragraph 23 says that no payment was made to my clients, Your Honor. Paragraph 23, I guess that's a particular paragraph that I rely on. I could go through the entire complaint and read through it, Your Honor, and I think it'll answer your question
But the defendant is Attorney Morris, correct?
Yes.
And so where does it allege that Attorney Morris deprived Anthony Inc. of the property interest that you're alleging in the IOTA account?
Let me try to find it exactly, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I don't know if I'm going to be able to give you the particular paragraph right now, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I guess I'll just rely on the allegations. I want to get to this direct derivative, I guess. I don't have a lot of time left. This was a direct claim. It's that simple. This is not a derivative claim. It all was about the distribution to the members. That's a direct claim. There was nothing. In order for there to be a derivative claim, the action has to affect all members of 415 LLC. This case does not affect all members of 415 LLC. Mr. Lang, the other member, got everything. So if he gets everything, he certainly isn't entitled to more in this claim. This was an issue of distribution to my clients, which should have been made and which was wholly ignored by the parties. Now, I need to address with this court the other two issues right now. One, the personal representatives do have a right to pursue this claim. I will concede that they are correct in saying that I didn't brief this issue, but I addressed it to the court. I would like to draw the court's attention to plaintiff's motion in opposition to defendant's motion for judgment on the pleadings dated March 11th of 2022. It is incorrect that there was any four-month, there is a recognition of a personal representative's right to pursue this claim under this four-month rule. They got out of it, they're saying, because we're one day past the 4 months. That four-month rule, Your Honor, is not properly applied in this case, and I argue, and I think it's true, it only applies to claims against them. I'm out of time.
You'll have time on rebuttal, though, so if there's some points you wanted to make, that would be a good time to make them.
If I can make it on rebuttal, I appreciate that, Your Honor. Thank you.
You're welcome. And counsel for respondent, you may approach and begin when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Brandon Meshbesher, and I represent the respondents in this action. This appeal raises three issues: whether the district court erred in dismissing appellant's conversion claim, whether the district court erred in dismissing the statutory treble damages claim under Minnesota statutes 481.07 and 481.071, and whether the district court erred in denying appellant's motion to amend to add the individual family members as plaintiffs, and as I just heard counsel say, now it also involves the personal representatives, although that issue is not submitted to the court in appellant's briefing. But I want to start where the court started, with the conversion claim. And the district court dismissed the conversion claim pursuant to respondents' motion for judgment on the pleadings on two separate and independent bases. First, there is the direct versus derivative claim issue. I think that issue is clear and was correctly decided by the district court. What the appellants are really alleging here is that the corporation, or the LLC, 415 LLC in this case, misappropriated corporate assets, misapplied them, wasted them, did something improper with them. As has been made clear in the briefing, the funds were always in the possession and control of 415 LLC. The funds were never in the possession of respondents. They were never controlled by respondents. They were never in the possession of the appellant, Anthony, Inc.
Did Anthony, Inc. have a property interest in the funds, as appellant argues, by virtue of the winding up process?
Well, no, is the short answer. What Anthony, Inc. had was a 50% membership in 415 LLC. Through the winding up process, the LLC is required to satisfy all creditors and obligations and other expenses before making any distributions from the surplus, if any, that remains. So before all of the creditors and obligations and other expenses are satisfied, there is no actual property interest in the corporate assets. I also disagree with counsel's assertion that all of the creditors and obligations were satisfied. That October 2018 order relating to the sale of the property only relates to the sale of the property and the expenses related to that sale. There were, and the record is clear on this, there were additional expenses that came after that. Other obligations, there was the Robert Schmidt declaratory judgment action that was settled after the sale, after Mr. Meyer's death, after the stipulation that is the subject of appellant's claim against my client, the respondents. So until all of the creditors and obligations were satisfied, there is no present or concrete property interest of the members.
Am I correct, counsel, that in the underlying lawsuit, which led to the stipulated order, which is raised confirming authority to the sole remaining living, I should say, member, and that litigation was against Stephen Meyer and Anthony Inc., as I see the caption of the case. So am I correct that that is where the issues of expenses and appropriate distribution was occurring with court supervision, essentially? And I even saw the string of emails that was attached, I think, to the complaint where the IOLTA account holder was waiting some direction from the court on when and who and how the authority to distribute the money. But I get the impression from all of that that included then some supervision of the appropriateness of the wind-down payment of expenses.
Yes, yeah, that is true, Your Honor, that the winding down was controlled by the court and supervised by the court in the dissolution action. There's also other courts and judges involved in overseeing the movement of funds. In the Schmidt lawsuit, Judge Robner made certain orders for the parties to move certain funds from that IOLTA account. There was the prior lawsuit before the dissolution action with Mr. Lang that also resulted in a stipulated order that was in play here and specifically referenced in the stipulation that is the subject of appellant's claim in this case. So yes is the answer.
And so as I see the complaint, the allegations related to Mr. Morris precedes and postcedes, I suppose, the timing of it, the winding down that was occurring with the money that the appellant is claiming that they were responsible or owed.
Right. Well, yeah, that's exactly right, Your Honor. Obviously, Mr. Myers and the owner of Anthony Inc. was alive when the dissolution action started. And Anthony Inc. retained Mr. Morris, my client, to represent Anthony Inc. in that dissolution action. Mr. Meyer passed away while that dissolution action was pending. The stipulation, the June 21, 2019 stipulation at issue in this lawsuit that was entered into by Mr. Morris, happened after Mr. Meyer's death, but before the end of the dissolution action. So the dissolution action continued for, I don't recall exactly off the top of my head, but many months, possibly almost a year after the stipulation that's at issue in this lawsuit was finalized. So the winding down process, to answer the court's question, had not concluded at the time the stipulation was entered into.
And one allegation that is made in the complaint, and this may be somewhat tangential, but it does go to the complaint allegation or statement that your client was not authorized once Mr. Meyer died, since he was the sole principal owner of Anthony Inc., to have signed that stipulation, which again, as I understand, is many steps away from where the money went and went from 415. But do you have a response to that?
Well, there are many reasons that I could think of where the stipulation may have been necessary. I mean, the appellant in the reply at page 6 seems to concede that this stipulation wasn't necessary for Mr. Lang, the sole living governor of 415 LLC, to do whatever he wanted with the funds. But setting that aside, I believe that many parts of the stipulation were required to comply with other orders of the court in the dissolution action and other underlying actions. And to the extent that the authority of Mr. Morris to enter into that stipulation is an issue. That is really more of an issue for the negligence claim that survived the Rule 12 motion and was subsequently dismissed on a different basis and is not part of this appeal. So in addition to the conversion claim, the merits of it, that 415 LLC was the rightful owner and sole rightful owner of the funds at issue, and Anthony Inc. never had a property interest. The claims are also derivative. I mean, it's really about the misappropriation of corporate funds and the appellant brings up that he's trying to assert a direct claim, right? This is a claim against an attorney. It's direct. You did something wrong to me. But that's not really the analysis that the courts employ when determining whether a claim is direct versus derivative. They don't look at the language used in couching the claim. They look at the injury. The injury here is the misappropriation of corporate funds. And that is a sort of textbook derivative claim. It's an injury to the corporation. Now, Mr. Lang's not going to get more money, assuming that he's the one that actually received it. We don't actually have that before us, but he might get less. The corporation might need to try to claw back some of those distributions that were made allegedly improperly. But derivative claim under the laws here in the state of Minnesota, and I think that's clear and was correctly decided by the district court. The statutory treble damages claim really rises and falls with the conversion claim. Without the conversion claim, there is no basis and no other claim in the complaint, because the civil theft claim has been waived, that could sustain it. Those statutes don't create their own independent cause of action. They provide a remedy that requires some companion claim to go along with it. And the district court correctly concluded that since the conversion claim and the civil theft claim had to be dismissed, the sole remaining claim, which at the time was negligence, was insufficient to sustain a claim for the remedies provided by those statutes, and the same should apply here.
Would you agree, even if the conversion claim, if I understood your argument in the brief, even if the conversion claim could survive, that still would not be a predicate, sufficient predicate basis for the treble damages?
Well, I would agree with that. There is an insufficient allegation of fraud or collusion. It's just not in the complaint. It's not properly pleaded, and that would be required for it to survive. I would also argue that the claim for treble damages is similarly derivative, because it involves, again, the basis of it is the misappropriation of corporate assets. So that would be another basis to uphold the dismissal of that claim. And then finally, the final issue before the court is the motion to amend. First, with respect to the personal representatives, that's improperly before the court. It was not raised by appellant in their briefing. Respondents did not have a chance to respond, but the district court properly found that the personal representatives were not proper parties because they had not been, or because Stephen Meyer had already passed away at the time of the alleged wrongful act. Therefore, there was no claim for Stephen Meyer that would survive him after his death. With respect to the individual family members, there is no attorney-client relationship between the individual family members and my client, respondents in this case. That is a fundamental element of any claim for malpractice or anything related to the attorney-client relationship, and it's absent here. The appellant argues that the court should apply a very limited exception that the Minnesota courts have created in the estate planning context. Appellants acknowledge that that exception has never been applied in the situation before the court here, where the attorney was hired to litigate a dissolution action or some other litigation matter.
Counsel, would you agree that if we agreed with your position that the district court correctly found no basis for the conversion and there's no other claims left, do we even need to get to that issue because there's no longer a complaint left for which there could be an error in failing to allow a party to join?
Yes, that is certainly true, that if there are no viable claims, there's nothing for the potential parties to join, and the issue would be moot if the court were to affirm the district court's order on the conversion claim. Unless the court has any further questions for me, I'll rest on the brief.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. And counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, Mr. Meshbasher basically indicated that our member has no right, that my client as a member of 415C as LLC has no right to these proceeds. They do have the right to the proceeds under the winding up statute. It's that simple. Now, what I wanted to address to the court, just a couple of things
quickly. Just to follow up on that, Mr. Johnson, isn't it true, though, you're missing some steps? It may have a right once the winding up is done and there's money left over, and then there was an allegation of a distribution other than according to the corporate division, right? I mean, at that stage, then Anthony would have a right in a very real legal sense, but only until you get to that point.
It's part of the winding up, Your Honor. As soon as the expenses are paid, which under this judgment on the pleadings is to be assumed as true, the right exists to the members to obtain the surplus. And that's exactly the situation in this case. We feel there was a conversion here because by Mr. Morris's conduct, their right, their expectancy was totally taken away, and the other 50% member got everything in 415 LLC, everything. And they used it. It's in the complaint. They actually used the money in a subsequent lawsuit to satisfy a personal liability of James Lang. They paid $300,000 out of that IOLTA account to satisfy that fund. That's wrong. This was unfair, is what it was. Now, do we need to submit an expert affidavit? Not at all. This is a very obvious intentional tort. We're not asserting any negligence. We're not asserting any breach of duty by this lawyer. We're saying you made a rag. You colluded with the other side and took everything away from our clients. And that's what happened exactly in this case. I have to address, though, also this idea of this direct beneficiary. It's important for this court to know that if we aren't allowed to pursue this case, James Lang gets away with everything. Robert Morris gets away with everything. He's immune from liability because you're not letting the personal representatives do anything. You're not recognizing that the family members are legitimate third-party beneficiaries. And I just want to read my argument in this regard. The similarity of the intent of the client, the benefit to an estate beneficiary, and the denial of a client's intent by an estate drafter. This is what happens in the cases, third-party beneficiary cases typically allowed, is where a third-party beneficiary comes in and says, I can come in because the estate drafter did something negligently here, did something wrong here, and therefore I can make the claim. Well, basically, this case is the same. It involves a lawyer who is representing a client who died. In the estate drafting context, it's obviously the client's not dead yet because he's doing the work for him. But in this case, this occurred after the client died. Under the Lucas factors, it's evident that these people are entitled to pursue the claim. This transaction was entitled to benefit the family, to benefit Stephen Meyer, who is deceased, and therefore his family members. Think of intestate succession or a will or whatever. Everyone, most people give their property to their to their family. And I think the district court in this case was entitled to make reasonable inferences in this regard under a judgment of a pleading standard, and they failed to do that. As far as the amendment of the complaint, keep in mind the district court said it would have been futile. Well, if this is a situation where indeed it was futile, the standard again returns to de novo. And in this situation, that means the district court should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today and the briefing. The matter is now submitted. We will issue an order within the 90 days. Have a good day. Thank you.